off of my cloud. Hey, welcome to the program. Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. If you're listening Friday night, that was a rerun. We were off Friday night. Interesting stuff on the program tonight, I think. Of course, that's just me. We're hoping to work in an Uncle Mike story corner. Also, a moment with Bob and some information about a book released by General Ricardo Sanchez, the coverage of which is being completely washed away by coverage of the book by Scott McClellan. Funny how that works. Anyway, let's start tonight with a couple of emails. First one is from Susan in Seattle, who writes, Mike, after the debate about Michigan and Florida, we finally reach a conclusion. She's referencing what happened on Saturday, of course, at the Democratic National Committee. Susan writes, hurrah! The Clinton followers are still not happy, though, even though the voters and candidates both knew that the primaries wouldn't count. I have a question for Clinton supporters. If Obama had won, quote-quote, both states, would they be fighting as hard to make sure the votes counted? Something, Susan writes, for Clinton supporters to ponder. Well, I don't know. I'm just very glad that this campaign season is over, or it will be tomorrow night, hopefully. And then we can get on with the business of destroying the Republican Party, peacefully and legally, of course, since they are purveyors of violence, hatred, stupidity, asininity, and most importantly, boredom. In the mini blog that I wrote today, or I guess it's a blog. I guess it's not a mini blog. It's a blog. I write one every day. Either I do or Kathy does. And you can tell who wrote by the initials at the end of the blog. KBM is She Who Must Be Obeyed. MDM is Moi. And today's blog was about, was about William Kristol's column in this morning's New York Times, one that I found excruciatingly offensive. And I did mention, I put a line in there, why are so many American Jewish men of a certain age such advocates of this death cult Nazi-like U.S. fascism? I put that line in there specifically because, in fact, so many of the so-called neoconservatives are Jewish men, Jewish American men of a certain age. Everybody from Wolfowitz to Pearl to Kristol, it just happens to be that way. And so, therefore, my question is entirely valid and a proper one to ask because I don't understand that. I don't understand that mindset. Now, I am stereotyping, and I'm the first to admit it. But I don't understand that sort of violent neo-fascist mindset in, of all people, Jewish men of American nationality who had parents or grandparents who were destroyed in the Nazi Holocaust. I can't get my mind around it. So I asked the question. I have an answer from Joel Weisberg, and I'll give his last name because I don't think he would mind. Joel writes, Mike, as a Jewish man and a big fan of your show, and as a founding member of Nova M, I just want to correct something that you wrote in your column today. You asked, why are so many American Jewish men of a certain age such advocates of this death cult Nazi-like U.S. fascism? Mike, while there are some of my people who do approve of this horrific policy, who voted for Bush, I believe overwhelmingly American Jews reject everything that's happened in the last seven miserable years. I refer to the 06 elections when 87% of the U.S. Jewish community voted Democratic. In my own circle of Jewish friends and family, all we talk about is the contempt with which we hold men like Kristol, Wolfowitz, Pearl, and Elliot Abrams, architects of much of the horror we have witnessed. I have breakfast every Saturday morning with 10 or so of my high school friends, all Jewish. To a man, we reject the Nazi-like actions of the above-mentioned cowards. I just wanted to set the record straight, Mike. Keep on giving them hell. Joel Weisberg. Let me make real clear that perhaps it was my use of the term or the phrase, why are so many American Jewish men? I completely agree with what Joel Weisberg has written here. I have probably as many okay, maybe not as many, but certainly a substantial number of Jewish friends of a certain age, my age, who almost to the last man do not defend anything that people like Crystal or Wolfowitz or Pearl or Abrams do support. So poor choice of terminology, I guess, or not terminology, but poor choice of sentence structure. How's that work, Joel? Will you buy that? Because I honestly did not mean to imply that a majority of Jews in this country agree with what the neocons have perpetrated. Certainly not. Absolutely not. So I answered Joel's email by saying I'll read your letter on the air tonight and make the point clear. Because it's one that I have no problem making clear. I get carried away sometimes. It's very seldom that you hear anyone mention the religious / cultural affiliation of so many members of PNAC that apparently has dissolved now, that it served its function, or the religious cultural affiliation of so many so-called neoconservatives. I mean, it's there, folks. What do we do? Pretend like it's not there? It's like pretending like of the 9 Supreme Court justices, 6 of them are not Catholic. I think it's 6, or is it 7? And that's why I certainly can understand a collective mindset of the Catholics, for example, on the U.S. Supreme Court. Is it 7 or is it less than that? I don't know. I know it's the majority. The majority, the religious affiliation of the majority of Supreme Court members is Catholic. I do know that. Lost my train of thought. It's difficult for me. I completely lost my train of thought, so let me just repeat. It's difficult for me to understand how the neoconservative line, whether it's domestic or foreign, as applied to foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy or U.S. domestic policy, how in the world that squares with the Jewish philosophy and thought and artistic and scientific endeavors and compassion and the whole thing. So see, I'm stereotyping. I can't put it all together, so hence the mention today. But anyway, thanks, Joel. Was it Joel or was it Barry? No, it was Joel. What else we have here? Oh, remember the anthrax attacks? Remember that? Doesn't that seem like just like, oh, God, what is it, 1,000 years ago? Huh? Forever ago? It was right after 9/11, wasn't it? Huh? Oh, that's right. Anthrax went to Tom Daschle and who else? Gosh, I forget. And went to where? ABC? Was it ABC? NBC? No. And some cheesy-ass newspaper down in Florida, one of those tabloid, checkout newspaper. Whatever happened to that story? Remember, huh? How often have you thought that? Never? Okay. Every once in a while, but the thought pops up, right? You'll read something, the anthrax attacks. Oh, yeah, what did that, who? Well, now it turns out, I was reading George Washington's blog the other day, and it says, even experts at the U.S. Bioweapons Facility at Fort Detrick think that the anthrax, which was used in those 2001 attacks, came from their facility. In an email obtained by Fox News, does that make it useless, worthless? I don't know. In an email, oh, we got a break here? All right, let's do a break, and I'll share with you what this email obtained by Fox News had to say about the anthrax powder that was sent to members of Congress and media people. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
Long as I got my plastic Jesus riding on the dashboard on my car. Through my trials and tribulations and my travels through the nations, with my plastic Jesus I'll go far. Riding down the thoroughfare, with a nose up in the air. A rig may be ahead.
It is 21 past the hour. All right. In an email obtained by Fox News, this is according to the George Washington's blog, in an email obtained by Fox News, scientists at Fort Detrick openly discussed how the anthrax powder they were asked to analyze after those attacks was nearly identical to that made by one of their colleagues. The quote goes on, then it was said that one of the scientists had to look at a lot of samples that the FBI had prepared to duplicate the letter material, the material sent through the letter, the email reads. Quote, then the bombshell. He said that the best duplication of the material was the stuff made by, the name is redacted here. He said that it was almost exactly the same. His knees got shaky and he sputtered, but I told the general, we didn't make spore powder, whatever that means, end of quote. Indeed, three of the four suspects the FBI is investigating are employees of Fort Detrick, which is run by the Army. The new information verifies that the anthrax came from the Fort Detrick military base. And then this Fox News thing goes on. Some people are pretending that someone unconnected with the Army bioweapons facility at Fort Detrick stole the anthrax. However, as the above-quoted article states, quote, Fort Detrick is run by the United States Army. It's the most secure biological warfare center in the United States. It's not very likely that someone could steal anthrax from the most secure facility in the U.S. run by the Army. Indeed, the FBI apparently knew in 2002, I'm not quoting Fox now, indeed, the FBI apparently knew in 2002 who mailed the anthrax letters. And yet, government investigators and prosecutors have covered up and refused to disclose it, who did it, for 6 years. Initially, the FBI tried to frame an innocent man for the attacks. And it goes on and it goes on. Bob in Miami wrote, anthrax was sent to Daschle and Leahy of Vermont, the only two who could block the Patriot Act, and the only two in Congress who received the anthrax about 2 weeks before the vote. They were thinking of blocking it before the anthrax letters. So, it goes on to say there's strong evidence that the anthrax attacks were a false flag attack. Indeed, the bioweapons expert who actually drafted the current bioweapons law while working for Pappy Bush has said that he is convinced the October 2001 anthrax attacks that killed five people were perpetrated and covered up by criminal elements of the U.S. government. The motive? To foment a police state by killing off and intimidating opposition to post-9/11 legislation, such as the USA Patriot Act and the later Military Commissions Act. At the very least, George Washington's blog concludes, the FBI and the White House are actively covering up for the person who really did it. I don't think there's any a doubt of that. I really don't. Anthrax of the sort that was sent to Daschle and Leahy and ABC or whoever the hell it was, has a chemical footprint that is very clear, easy to understand. It is weapons-grade anthrax. It is not something that you whip up in your basement laboratory while you figure out ways to stop the evil ones from invading from some place in the ninth dimension. This is stuff that is put together at a weapons laboratory, which obviously it was. It is also something, I mean, you don't have to be a member of the United States Army to have access to the Army's Fort Detrick, do you? You can be a highly placed civilian. Let me see. Who would have, maybe the vice president would have access. I think he probably would. I think it would be very easy for a directive to come from a Dick Cheney ordering one of the civilian chemists, is that the right word, who worked at Fort Detrick at the time to devise, concoct, and send something to warn, hopefully to kill a few of them, but something to warn members of Congress, all right, phase two is coming, the USA Patriot Act. Don't you out-of-control little sons of bitches try to pretend like you share power with the executive branch, because you don't. Here's your shot across the bow. We live in strange times, don't we? General Ricardo Sanchez has a book out. Huh? It's titled Wiser in Battle, A Soldier Story. The book and the author are not going to get, neither the book nor the author is going to get the kind of airtime that simpering Scotty McClellan has gotten as Mr. McClellan works his way from talk show to talk show to sell his book. And the news media can gasp and ooh and ah and stare at each other and say, well, we didn't. What are we supposed to do? We didn't. General Ricardo Sanchez, 3 stars, I believe, and the former head of American ground forces in Iraq is not going to get the same kind of attention. When we come back, I'll tell you just a couple of excerpts from his book of what he said. You might find it interesting. This is Nova M. I'm Mike Malloy.
The fact it was just a wedding. The fact is there's these prisoners buried in the sand, mass murdered in containers. The fact is in Afghanistan more die than in New York, and most of them civilians. Hail Caesar! This is what you're fighting for. The king of death row, Texas, elected by his brother-in-law. Hail Caesar! This is what you're fighting for. Oil money, Enron, the American Empire!
Malloy on Nova M Radio. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
You little devil. All right, I'm getting a whole lot of emails here on the anthrax thing. Well, I'll come back to it in just a second. Okay? Well, no, it's very astute audience. But back to General Ricardo Sanchez. You remember him, don't you? And yes, it has to be nice to be able to retire and finally be free to speak your mind. Now, keep in mind that Ricardo Sanchez, Lieutenant General, 3 stars, the man who led American ground forces in Iraq from 2003 to 2004, he's released a new book titled Wiser in Battle, A Soldier's Story. It takes aim at the Bush administration, with some of the strongest criticism yet from a former Iraq commander. I mean, it keeps rolling out. It seems like every single person who has had anything to do, William Odom is another one. Of course, he just died last week, but General William Odom, every single flag rank officer who has had command of forces in Iraq, following and honoring the tradition in this country of military civilian control of the military, once they are free from these pigs who run this government now, they speak out. This is what Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez said. This is an excerpt from National Public Radio, an interview. Here's his quote. In the aftermath of the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, I watched helplessly as the Bush administration led America into a strategic blunder of historic proportions. It became painfully obvious that the executive branch of our government did not trust its military. It relied instead on a neoconservative ideology developed by men and women with little, if any, military experience. Some senior military leaders did not challenge civilian decision makers at the appropriate times, and the courageous few who did take a stand were subsequently forced out of the service. End quote. Now, how is the pig man, Limbaugh, and his little butt boy, Sean Hannity, and the rest of these right-wing pieces of human waste, how are they going to spin General Ricardo Sanchez as hating the troops, trying to undermine the effort? How are they going to do that? Now, the sad fact is most Americans are not going to hear of Ricardo Sanchez's book because we are hearing, and maybe it's over now. It was a big rush last week, wasn't it? We are hearing of Simple Scotty McClellan's book. Ow, they made me lie. Ow, ouch. There's more. From Wiser in Battle, A Soldier's Story. This was at talkingpointsmemo.com, and it's originally from the Washington Post. Michael Abramowitz's post there at Washington Post, or article at Washington Post. And here's what he says. Getting lost in media furor over McClellan's memoirs, the new autobiography of retired General Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the one-time commander of U.S. troops in Iraq, who is scathing in his assessment that the Bush administration, quote, led America into a strategic blunder of historic proportions, end quote. Among the anecdotes is an arresting portrait of Bush after the four contractors were killed in Fallujah in 2004, which triggered a fierce U.S. response that was reportedly egged on by the president. During a video conference with his national security team and generals, Sanchez writes, Bush launched into what he described as a confused pep talk. Kick ass, he quotes the president as saying. If somebody tries to stop the march to democracy, we will seek them out and kill them. We must be tougher than hell. This Vietnam stuff, this is not even close. It is a mindset. We can't send that message. It's an excuse to prepare us for a withdrawal. There's a series of moments, and this is one of them. Our will is being tested, but we are resolute. We have a better way. Stay strong. Stay the course. Kill them. Be confident. Prevail. We are going to wipe them out. We are not blinking. End quote. George Bush, via General Ricardo Sanchez. Now, I have more on that quote in just a moment when we do tonight's Moment with Bob. Meanwhile, this is from, where is this from? It's two or three pieces here all tied together. One from afterdowningstreet.org and two from the Washington Post, put together by Sheila. General William Odom, a fierce critic of Bush and Cheney, who had been steadfast in his calls for the madness to stop by insisting that Bush and Cheney be impeached. General William Odom, on March 17th, he insisted that Congress stop shoveling money into this occupation and impeach both Bush and Cheney. That was in the afterdowningstreet.org. It's an audio there that you can hear. You can hear General William Odom saying Congress should impeach these two bastards. On April 2nd, that was 17th of March, on April 2nd this year, he went before Congress where he justified an immediate withdrawal from Iraq. On May 27th, what was that, last week, for God's sake, he and Zbigniew Brzezinski teamed up to write an opinion piece in the Washington Post about the sensible way to deal with Iran. 3 days later, on May 30th, which was last, what was that, Friday, Odom died. The Sheila writes, the sounds of Odom crashing to the ground were drowned out by round-the-clock media shrieks of indignation about Snotty Scotty's disloyal little diatribe. Do you suppose Keith Olbermann can pull himself off Orly's leg long enough to comment on this tragedy? Maybe, Sheila, maybe not. But going to the afterdowningstreet.org audio, General William Odom, in a wide-ranging, hour-long discussion on live radio, said he sees two useful things Congress can do. Cease funding the occupation of Iraq. Now, this is just March of this year. And impeach Bush and Cheney. Who, you may be asking, is General William Odom? Well, he earned his reputation, his national reputation, as an expert on the Soviet Union. In 1977, he was appointed as the military assistant to Zbigniew Brzezinski, the hawkish assistant to Jimmy Carter, for national security affairs. From the 2nd of November 1981 until 12 May 1985, Odom served as the Army's assistant chief of staff for intelligence, and from 1985 to 1988, he served as the director of the National Security Agency under Ronald Reagan. Not exactly your classic Limbaugh brain-addled simpering liberal, is he? No. Odom, and this is David Swanson wrote this, Odom was energized during the radio show and continued the discussion off the air, at which point he told me he'd wished to mention that Al-Qaeda's websites show a new theme. Al-Qaeda wants to get the United States to attack Iran. Odom remarked on a situation in which Lieberman, Ehud Olmert, and Al-Qaeda all agree. William Odom and Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote a piece for the Washington Post, which we'll post at my website tonight. This was Tuesday, May the 27th. And then 3 days later, May the 30th, this was in the Washington Post yesterday. William Odom, 75, retired Army Lieutenant General, who was a senior military and intelligence official in the Carter Reagan administrations and who in recent years became a forceful critic of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, died May 30th at his vacation home in Lincoln, Vermont. An autopsy will be performed, but his wife said he had an apparent heart attack. He had a reputation as a military hardliner who opposed any compromise with the old Soviet Union. Brzezinski said yesterday, quote, among senior military people, he was probably the first to consider the war in Iraq a misbegotten adventure. He believed that we were just stoking hostility to the United States in that region and developing an opposition that cannot be defeated by military means. He was very outspoken, end quote. Well, before the U.S.-led invasion, in 2003, General Odom warned that military action in Iraq would be foolhardy and futile. He outlined his positions in the Washington Post, February 11, 2007, in the essay, quote, victory is not an option, end quote. He wrote, quote, the president's policy is based on illusions, not realities, end quote.
Fighting for all of our lives, and now fighting for children, for homes and for wives, fighting for the memory of all who fell before. But the soldiers are.
Ready for Radical Talk Radio? Make mine Mike Malloy on Nova M.
It's 10 before the hour, and oh yeah, General Odom in his obituary. He died Saturday, I believe. 3 days after he and Zbigniew Brzezinski published the op-ed piece in the Washington Post. He is survived by his wife of 45 years, and a son, Army Lieutenant Colonel Mark Odom, who was wounded in action in Iraq, a brother, a sister, and a granddaughter. Odom, Sanchez, just doesn't stop, does it? I can't quite understand, then, why the Democratic leaders of the House, and the Senate for that matter, because they could exert influence on the House leadership, why the Democratic leaders of the House or the Senate don't begin conferencing about impeachment. There's plenty of time. Plenty of time. Impeachment, again, for the unenlightened, that would be Republicans, impeachment is nothing more nor less than an indictment. A presentation, if you will, to a grand jury kind of thing, where the evidence is brought out that lays out the case for removal from office. This is going to blow right by, isn't it? 8 years of the most criminal administration in this country's history. 8 years. It's going to blow right by. Because I don't believe for a moment that a President Barack Obama is going to pursue these bastards once he becomes president, if in fact he becomes president. I am absolutely convinced that a President Hillary Clinton will not pursue these criminals once she were to become president, if she were. McCain, forget it. So it appears that once again, I mean, the last Bush to hold office also was involved in criminal activity, massive violations of human rights, war crimes as definable by the laws or the rules set out at Nuremberg. Just the mining of the harbors of Nicaragua was a war crime. But what did Bill Clinton do when he took office? Nah, time to move on. Time to move on. And I have a reasonable expectation that that's what the next Democratic president of the United States will do, will say. Well, time to move on. You know, let history sort that out. Time to move on. And these filthy, putrid criminals, these people who have brought such dishonor to not just the office of the presidency, and I know that's a quaint statement, have brought such dishonor. I know that doesn't even compute anymore, does it? Who in the hell cares about honor anymore? Honor? They have brought such dishonor, not just to the office of the presidency, but also to this country. And they're going to escape. That is not even a commenting on the criminal activity in which they've been involved for 8 years. God only knows where the truth is about 9/11. And no, we will revisit that issue. I promised. I said it would be periodic. From 9/11, the events of that awful day and the lead up to and events subsequent, through every single criminal act that these sons of bitches have perpetrated, the loss of honor, the loss of respect, the destruction of what at one time was a self-defined superpower, which, you place your money and make your bets on that one, but a superpower that had a reputation, deserved or not, and in so many instances not deserved, as being this shining beacon of truth, justice, and the American way, now destroyed. Or if not destroyed, the facade ripped away so that people can really see what this country is about and has always been about. Only we usually kept it pretty well disguised, at least for the past 110 years, we kept it pretty well disguised. But they're going to escape, aren't they? They're going to walk out the door, these neocon bastards. Then, I guess, as a secondary means of securing justice, and this would not be justice because it happens to all of us. I was going to say the secondary means would be that each of them, as they leave this Bush crime family, that their lives after what they've done will be, what's the phrase? Short, nasty, and brutish. Is that right? Have I got that right? Huh?
I think the philosopher's name was Hume. Nasty, brutish, short, or something else.
Full of worms. And I hate to think about that. I hate to think of the fact that they, it appears they're going to escape. They're going to walk away from all the death and destruction. But Pappy Bush's regime walked away, didn't they? Every single last one of the bastards. All the way down to the psychopathic Oliver North. They all walked away. Most of them wound up in Junior's administration. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. We still have a moment with Bob. A couple more comments here on the anthrax thing. And if possible, Uncle Mike's Story Corner tonight. I'm Mike Molloy. This is Nova M. Stay with us. Welcome back. 6:30 past the hour. Okay, just to clear up here, a couple of topics. First of all, it was Thomas Hobbes, thanks to Bill in Ottawa, and a lot of you who... I can't remember all this stuff. It was from the book Leviathan that some will say established the foundation for most of Western political philosophy, but... Anyway, as Bill writes, Hobbes postulates what life would be like without government. Isn't that what libertarians believe? A condition which he calls the state of nature. In that state, each person would have a right or license to everything in the world. This inevitably leads to conflict. Bellum omnium contra omnes. A war of all against all, and thus lives that are solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Thanks, Bill. Regarding the anthrax, Kathy in Green Bay writes, the anthrax went to Tom Daschle and Pat Leahy, the only two people who could have easily stopped the Patriot Act. Daschle, as Senate Majority Leader, controlled whether or not it got to the floor. Leahy, as Chairman of Judiciary, could have kept it in committee. What a coincidence, Kathy writes. Also, Bill wrote, Mike, just a quick comment. Anthrax comes from a spore. It is biologically based, so it has DNA. Everyone knows how reliable DNA is, so it's important to note that the anthrax in question was sequenced and compared to weaponized anthrax from Dietrich, and it is identical. This is much better than a chemical signature, as you just said. In fact, there can be no dispute. Having said that, I remember reading a report in the New York Times which attempted to backtrack on that claim, which concluded it was not the particular strain from Fort Detrick. But it's too late now. There's no way a mistake was made. They cannot take it back. I'm looking for that article, Bill. And, of course, Citizens for Legitimate Government... has put out all sorts of articles about this from all the way back in 2005. And Cindy writes, you know, why when Fox reports it all of a sudden becomes a story. Well, that kind of wasn't the point. When Scott McClellan says Bush lied, why is that news? You know, I've been railing on that for a week now. It's just the fact that it has leaked into mainstream media, if that's what we want to agree that Fox News is. And also from Bill, soon after first press reports that the anthrax used in the attacks was of the Ames strain, that's from Iowa State University, that university briefly became the prime suspect in a media hunt for the source. Governor Thomas Vilsack at the time called out the National Guard and state police to guard the anthrax stores. Iowa State researchers got rid of the problem by baking their anthrax specimens in an autoclave, type of oven used to sterilize surgical instruments. Iowa State University says it received permission from the FBI and the CDC to destroy the anthrax. But now, no one will ever know whether the Iowa State anthrax was the Ames strain, perhaps even the original. That dismays a Dr. Smith, who I guess was doing the research. He says it sounds like a damn convenient thing to autoclave it. And then WW says, Mike, it was called codename Artichoke. That was the U.S. government's name for our chemical weapons program. In the 70s, the men in charge of the U.S. government anthrax research program were none other than a young Richard Cheney and one Donald Rumsfeld. They've been playing with germs for about 30 years now. It's worth checking out, and there are excerpts from a documentary called Codename Artichoke that verifies this. The documentary is almost impossible to find, I'll bet. And then regarding my statements about Jewish Americans who were so heavily involved in the Project for New American Century and the attack on Iraq and, you know, U.S. policy that has been such an absolute debacle for the past 8 years. There is a new group out. Gordon writes, you and the audience may be interested to know of J Street. And you can check these folks out at jstreet.org, letter J, street.org. And this is from their webpage. Quote, for too long, the only voices politicians and policymakers have heard on American policy toward Israel and the Middle East have been from the far right. It is high time that mainstream pro-Israel, pro-peace Americans fought back for real peace and security, end quote. And if you want to check this out, I've heard of them, Gordon, J Street. They just recently surfaced in the news, what, a week or two ago? Go to jstreet.org, jstreet.org. What else do we have here? Let me see. If you follow the business pages at all, I occasionally read business sections of the New York Times and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Wall Street, so-called Wall Street investors, are not willing at this point, even with this energy crunch that we're going through, and it's not really an energy crunch, the ending of the use of fossil fuels, the ending of so much that we have to face in this generation. Investors are still unwilling to finance new nuclear plants. Too much liability involved, too much. Not that the investors are worried about, the Wall Street investors are worried about nuclear disasters killing people. They're worried about nuclear disasters resulting in lawsuits. There is a huge difference. People are easily replaceable or dispensable. Massive lawsuits are just a super pain in the ass. They just go on forever, and if you lose them, it's just money, 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 and you have to pay all these high-priced defense attorneys. You know, if it's just a matter of people dying and everyone shutting up, no big deal. But the lawsuits! So Wall Street investors, so-called, are unwilling to finance new nuclear plants. Guess what? Into the breach steps. Senators Joe Lieberman of Connecticut and John Warner of Virginia, they've come up with a scheme to provide $500 billion, $544 billion in subsidies, government subsidies. That means public financing. That means out of your pocket and my pocket for new nuclear power plant development. Now, this is going to be debated on the floor of the Senate tomorrow, Tuesday, tomorrow. So if you have available time, check out C-SPAN and see if they carry this one. A Lieberman aide describes the plan as, quote, the most historic incentive for nuclear in the history of the United States, end quote. Wow, man. Now, the Lieberman-Warner scheme is hidden in a climate change bill, the claim being that nuclear power plants don't emit greenhouse gases and thus don't contribute to global warming. Well, the first part of the sentence is true. They don't emit greenhouse gases. However, the overall nuclear cycle involved here, which includes mining and milling and fuel enrichment and fabrication and reprocessing, has all of, each one of those individual processes has significant greenhouse gas emissions. So once you have the finished product, your hot little nuclear core that you can now begin to generate energy from which you can begin to generate energy, okay, no carbon dioxide comes out of that, no none of these other atmospheric gases that were blowing them, none of it there. But what about the process to get there? Huh? According to the article at Common Dreams, Wall Street is uneasy, rightfully regarding nuclear power as terribly risky. Six of the nation's largest investment banks, including Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Morgan Stanley, last year told the U.S. Department of Energy that the risks make lenders unwilling to extend long-term credit, end quote. And as if right on cue, enter Senators Lieberman and Warner. $500 billion of public money to, never mind.
A lot of gas reserves around the world. Gas is, can only be transported by ship, though, when you liquefy it, when you put it in solid form. Literacy in math.
You dumb bastard. You dumb bastard! Have we got time for an Uncle Mike Story Corner? Huh? You think? Think we can do it? Think we can squeeze it in here? It's not a very long one. You want to try Uncle Mike's Story Corner? Gather around, kiddies. It's time once again Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Everybody comfy? Got your jammies on? A little bit hot out there tonight, isn't it? Huh? Hope you have your short jammies on. This comes from the Miami Herald, written by Saban Willett. It's entitled The Most Famous Journalist in the World. The world's most famous journalist isn't Peter Arnett or Bob Woodward or Carl Bernstein or Dan Rather. His name is Sami Alhaj. Chances are you've never heard of him, and that should worry you. Al-Haj is a television cameraman from Sudan, and until this month he was a prisoner in the U.S. detention camp at Guantanamo Bay. For years, Al Jazeera followed his odyssey day by day. Al-Haj became famous to the millions across Asia and Europe who watched the Arab satellite channel's broadcasts and read its website, but he remained all but unknown in America. Most Americans never saw his photograph in mainstream American newspapers or heard about him on television. Like other journalists, Al-Haj covered the Afghanistan war in late 2001. Armed with a television camera, he sought to re-enter Afghanistan on December 15, 2001, as his film crew had done since October. A Pakistani border guard seized him and turned him over to Americans, and that began a seven-year nightmare. Al-Haj was sent to a Pakistani jail, to the American air base at Kandahar, and for long years to Guantanamo, where his imprisonment included force feeding by nasal tube after he stopped eating in protest. The Bush administration hinted darkly that Al-Haj was linked to Osama bin Laden, that he'd been involved in transporting weapons and funding terrorist organizations. The administration produced no evidence to support its charges, and Al-Haj denied them, noting the considerable and obvious evidence that he was literally a card-carrying journalist. He was never charged with a crime. He was never brought before a judge. At last, as suddenly and as inexplicably as he'd been captured, he was released. There was a time when the imprisonment of a journalist without charges would have caused an uproar in this country. Or even when it happened abroad, when BBC journalist Alan Johnston was captured and held in Gaza, his story was widely covered and his detention was rightly deplored in the U.S. At the time, Haj had already been a prisoner at Guantanamo for years, and when Johnston was released 2 months later, Al-Haj remained in prison. The silence of the American press was deafening. As his lawyer charitably suggested, Al-Haj's initial capture may have been an honest mistake. Any competent journalist tracking this story, however, would soon have uncovered a more insidious narrative. Al-Haj's news crews had covered the human aftermath of American bombing in Afghanistan, and Algeria broadcast images of the savage cost of warfare that the Bush administration would prefer the world not see. So was Al-Haj a terrorist or a foil through whom the administration hoped to discredit one of its most persistent media critics and perhaps intimidate others? If Al-Haj was a terrorist, why didn't the administration charge and try him? Why did it release him? Although he was interrogated more than 130 times at Guantanamo, his interrogators never found any link between Al Jazeera and bin Laden. Was this journalist imprisoned, beaten, and interrogated because, as far as the Bush administration was concerned, the enemy was a critical and influential press organization? Was Al-Haj imprisoned because the administration thought it could exploit him to discredit Al Jazeera? Is that what made Al-Haj an enemy combatant? Not so long ago, our press would at least have asked these questions. It should have been shouting from the rooftops about Al-Haj, demanding evidence, a trial, the truth. But our press was silent. We've seen all too recently what can happen when a compliant and docile press meekly accepts the administration's line. 5 years ago, when war momentum fevered the nation, most mainstream media became cheerleaders, abandoning their professional duty of relentless skepticism. So too with Al-Haj. So too, even where one of their own is involved. Today, the war drums are rumbling again, this time for Iran. Will our press stand its post or pick up the pom-poms of 2002 and 2003? Everybody, we'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Lavoie. This is Nova M.
That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Uncle Mike doesn't like to have his story corner interrupted with commercial breaks and station IDs and tacky little headline newscasts. No, he doesn't. Now, where was Uncle Mike? Oh, yes, the story of Sammy Alhaj. Uncle Mike will not go back and start over. For those of you good little children sitting there patiently in your jammies, Uncle Mike will just pick up approximately where he left off. We've seen all too recently what can happen when a compliant and docile press meekly accepts the administration's line. 5 years ago, when war momentum fevered the nation, most mainstream media became cheerleaders, abandoning their professional duty of relentless skepticism. So too with Sami Alhaj. So too, even where one of their own is involved. Today the war drums are rumbling again, this time for Iran. Will our press stand by its post or pick up the pom-poms of 2002 and 2003? The omens aren't good. The most famous journalist in the world was imprisoned by Americans without charge for almost 7 years, was beaten, isolated, humiliated, force-fed, relentlessly interrogated, and then quietly released. And you never heard about him. That was another episode, although interrupted, of Uncle Mike's Story Corner, brought to you by your friends at the Miami Herald. All right, what else? You want to do a moment with Bob right now? I think we'd better do a moment with Bob. Do we have? And if anybody tries to start commercial breaks, kill them. Uncle Mike is being surrounded by tacky theme music tonight. It's time once again for a moment with Bob. Bob writes, "Hey Mike, we're all too familiar with how George W. Bush mangles the English language. For example, you're working hard to put food in your family. I can press when there needs to be pressed. I can hold hands when there needs to be hold hands. And Sergeant General, I want to thank you for your service, and I appreciate the fact that you really snatched defeat out of the jaws of those who are trying to defeat us in Iraq." The realization that these are the words of the President of the United States makes sane people cringe, and the mouth breathers that support Bush grin and clap their hands in glee. Mark Crispin Miller, author of the Bush Dyslexicon, said in an interview, quote, "He has no trouble speaking off the cuff when he's speaking punitively, when he's talking about violence, when he's talking about revenge. When he struts and thumps his chest, his syntax and grammar are fine. It's only when he leaps into the wild blue yonder of compassion or idealism or altruism that he makes these hilarious mistakes," end quote. In Bush on the Couch, Inside the Mind of the President, Dr. Justin Frank wrote of Bush's failure of empathy, failure of concern, and a failure to act and take care of people. Bush has no trouble speaking coherently when he's talking about violence. As a former commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez discovered and recorded in his memoir, Wiser in Battle, A Soldier's Story, the following. On April 6, 2004, L. Paul Bremer III, head of the Occupation's Coalition Provisional Authority, and General Sanchez were in Iraq in a video teleconference with President Bush, Secretary of State Colin Powell, and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Well, obviously, this is not from Wiser in Battle, but let us continue. The first full-scale American offensive against the Sunni city Fallujah was being launched, and U.S. forces were preparing for a campaign against cleric Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army militia in Iraq's Shiite south. Colin Powell said, quote, "We've got to smash somebody's ass quickly," Sanchez reports him saying. "This has to be a total victory somewhere. We must have a brute demonstration of power," end quote. Regarding al-Sadr, President Bush said, quote, "At the end of the campaign, al-Sadr must be gone," he insisted. "At a minimum, he will be arrested. It is essential he be wiped out," end quote. Then Bush began what Sanchez describes as, quote, "a kind of confused pep talk regarding both Fallujah and our upcoming southern campaign," end quote. Quote, "Kick ass," Bush said. "If somebody tries to stop the march to democracy, we will seek them out and kill them. We must be tougher than hell. This Vietnam stuff, this is not even close. It is a mindset. We can't send that message. It's an excuse to prepare us for withdrawal. There's a series of moments, and this is one of them. Our will is being tested, but we are resolute. We have a better way. Stay strong. Stay the course. Kill them. Be confident. Prevail. We are going to wipe them out. We are not blinking." End quote. His syntax and grammar were just fine that day. He had no trouble describing what was to happen to people who had the impudence to rise up against the illegal invasion of their own country. "Kill them! We're going to wipe them out!" These are not the words of a comic book supervillain, some Nazi thug from a World War II propaganda film, nor from Ernst Stavro Blofeld, James Bond's arch-enemy. No, these are the words of a war criminal of the highest order, the President of the United States. In the good old days of World War II, it went something like this. "Kill the enemy soldiers and destroy their cities until the enemy's leadership surrenders." And that worked in World War II. In Vietnam, it didn't. A war of attrition is the killing of so many soldiers and civilians that the will to fight is lost. What made the U.S. military and political leaders think that the United States had more willpower to fight a war in a far-off country than the people who lived there? The United States invaded Vietnam and with every death created another enemy. The only way to win was to kill everyone. But the American people, tired of being lied to, gave up on the Vietnam War and the politicians who had sold it. George W. Bush and his military advisors have either not learned the lesson of the Vietnam War, that no military solution was viable, or they have learned them all too well. We must kill them all. In George Bush's words, a Pyrrhic victory isn't a bad thing because he doesn't know what it means. The word victory is in there somewhere, and that's good enough for him. He doesn't realize that when someone comes home to a smoking crater, to where a house once stood, where a family once lived, where beneath the rubble lies bloody remains, along with crushing grief comes the resolve to do whatever possible to make the people responsible for this crime pay. Somewhere there is an Iraqi survivor of Al-Fallujah, Ar-Ramadi, Haditha, or Baghdad, repeating a mantra taught word for word by Bush personally. Kill them. Wipe them out. One of the many funny things George W. Bush has said, but isn't that what all madmen mutter endlessly while slouching towards Bethlehem? Thus, another moment with Bob. Now, what was the title of that one? Funny Things Bush Has Said. Uncle Mike is watching his program unravel tonight. Maybe it's time to do some phone calls. We're going to come to the phone calls in just a moment. Roz writes from Canada, "Mike, is it mandatory to address AIPAC now in order to get ahead in U.S. politics?" Must be. McCain chatted up the pro-Israel lobby group, which must have made Bill Kristol very happy indeed. How come Israel is the only country that always has to be placated, addressed, and given tributes from the politicians in the United States? He made them, McCain did, some hateful promises and approached them like a beggar, hat in hand for their approval. It's really galling. Here's a link to a short article regarding what was said. Obama has also done his share in offering unwavering support. We have to face the fact that Israel and the United States are apparently joined now at the hip. Regards, Roz. And Roz includes the article from CNN of McCain today calling for tougher worldwide pressure on Iran. Oh, and he tried to describe Barack Obama as being naive about the Middle East. Well, at least Barack Obama can keep straight who is who in that sad part of the world. At least Barack Obama can honestly say that walking the streets of Baghdad without a damn near a full regiment of Marines in attendance would not be something that one would choose to do if one were, oh, I don't know what, sane? Well, I think it is time to do some phone calls, which we'll do after this break. The phone number here is 800-989-1480 if you'd like to join in the clamor. Primarily, hopefully, about what we've talked about so far in the program tonight. So if you're not on hold, now's a good time to get there. The number again, 800-989-1480. Your phone calls when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio.
Out, join your friends at the NSA and Homeland Security and listen to Mike Malloy every single night. They never miss a minute.
It's about 9 before the hour. Quick email here from Dan in Atlanta. He writes, Mike, it seems that the right-wingers are getting their jollies by continuing to refer to the senator from Illinois by all three names, Barack Hussein Obama. Of course, it is to try to scare the ones who do, in fact, cling to their Bibles and guns into thinking that he is Muslim. Also, they think that it makes the rest of us really angry, and that makes them happy, since it's not like there's anything else going on in the world that they feel they should be concerned about. I was not a supporter of either Obama or Clinton, but with Obama as the likely nominee, I say now that I will vote for him in the general election. To that end, I propose that we attempt to turn the tables on the right wing and refer to the senator as Barack Hussein Obama whenever speaking his full name. I also will refer to the Arizona senator as John Sidney McCain III. Why should Obama be ashamed of it? Why should we be afraid to speak it? It's his name. He didn't ask for it. The name is not Muslim, it's Arabic. And as we know, there are lots of Arab Christians, Jews, and agnostics as well. It's a fine name, and he should be proud of it. Going forward, I will refer to the senator as Barack Hussein Obama as a show of respect and to show people that a name, especially a middle name, is not something to be feared. I hope others will consider doing the same. Dan in Atlanta. Actually, Lawrenceville. Barack Hussein Obama. Oh, Katie barred the door. Give me my gun. Where's the Bible? Barack Hussein Obama. Yeah, you know it's coming, don't you? Huh? You know it's coming. You know what the sick, degenerate political right, that all translates to Republicans, what they are going to attempt to do with Barack Hussein Obama and the mouth-breathing, Bible-clutching, gun-toting Americans who will do anything in their power to make sure that the queers can't get married. Right? You know what's going to happen. You know what this campaign season is going to be like after tomorrow night. Right? Huh? Let's do some phone calls. Starting with Stephen, who is calling from Miami, listening to WINZ. Stephen, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Mike?
I'm all right.
Okay, Mike. Two generals I wanted to get my information straight on. You said one general came out with a book today about the anthrax attacks.
No. General Sanchez.
Oh, okay. That's the name. General Sanchez. That book, let me get the name Sanchez. And what was the name of that book?
I'll tell you what. Go to my website after.
No, I don't have it. Never had a That's all right.
You don't have
it? I've never had a computer, no. Never have. Never will.
Okay.
That's all right. I got the name General Sanchez. When did it come out, roughly, that book that he came out with?
The past couple of days.
All right. So eventually the bookstores, if you look up the name General Sanchez, they'll know the name. They'll be able to find the name of his book.
There you go.
Okay, I'm sure that works.
Okay.
And the other thing I wanted to make sure about the other general, William Odom. He passed away on the 30th.
Uh-huh.
And before that, approximately how long before that did he promote the idea of impeaching Bush and Cheney?
Starting back in March.
That's just this past March, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's very recent, in my opinion.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
Anything else?
That's like a smoking gun, Mike.
Yeah. No, I meant, you know, like, how are you fixed for socks and underwear? Anything else I can do for
you? No, don't worry about that. I just want to make sure one other progressive talk show hosts that you know of that already know about Odom.
Say it again?
Are there other progressive talk show hosts?
Yes. All of them, yeah.
Yes, I just want to make sure they talk about that.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's like a smoking gun that the mainline media should talk about. Someone like Katie Couric, for example.
Uh-huh.
They should be talking about that.
Yeah, they should.
Because that's obvious what's going on. He's trying to stop, I believe, what they're planning to do with Iran.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And that could come either this month or next month, as a matter of fact.
It definitely could. There's no question about that.
Yeah, but no matter what you think, you don't put someone like a general away just because you don't like what he's saying.
You do if you're the Bush administration.
No, you don't. Well, he's going to find out otherwise. Because I'm going to do all I can to make sure a lot of people find out about that.
Well, that's good. Thank you, Stephen. I got a boogie. It's time for the big top of the hour break. Thanks for checking in, Stephen. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M Radio. Welcome back to Stephen, listening on WINZ in Miami. It's Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez's book, and it's titled Wiser in Battle, A Soldier's Story. All right, Stephen. And I honestly don't know if or how many other progressive talk show hosts will talk about it. Regarding the soon-to-be-launched presidential campaign between McCain and, apparently, Obama, Mayflower Mike writes, "This campaign will be racist and nasty and mean. McCain will see to it. I already hear from very good sources that a 5-7 group is preparing a commercial that shows African leaders and the mess their countries are in, plus some big city African-American mayors and the mess their cities are in, with the tagline, think about it. Hell, this group, now that I think about it, might be funded by Hillary." Come on, Mike. "It's hard enough," he writes, "to beat someone from the other party in a national election. Now we have to worry about Hillary and Bill." Now we have to worry about Hillary and Bill trying to affect the 2008 election for Obama so she can run again in 2012. Damn, do these people ever go away. Signed, Mayflower Mike. If we begin to see commercials like that, I don't know. Then this country truly deserves whatever it gets. And if there's any media outlet that would run that sort of political ad, then of course we should get exactly what we deserve. Just an update here before we go back to your phone calls on Limbaugh's Operation Chaos. The ACLU has filed a lawsuit against the city of Denver after an open records request for information about the purchasing of security equipment for the Democratic National Convention was denied. That request was denied. The ACLU wants to know what weapons the city of Denver is buying for crowd control during the rumored protests this August during the Democratic National Convention. Is it August? I think it's August. Is it August? Someone asked the ACLU, "Aren't you asking the police to reveal their tactics?" And the ACLU, Mark Silverstein of the ACLU in Denver, says, "No, we're not asking the police to reveal tactics. We're asking the police to reveal how they're spending the public's money." And according to CBS4 in that city, the city has already allocated millions of dollars for security equipment purchases. Officials said they are planning for a peaceful event, but they are ready for contingencies. The protest group Recreate 68, that's the one that I, Mike Malloy, feel is a front organization run by government operatives, Bush crime family operatives, probably financed by Rush Limbaugh. The protest group Recreate 68 says it believes the city is buying high-tech weaponry. Glenn Spagnuolo of Recreate 68 told CBS4, quote, "We could save them a whole lot of money by just talking with us and de-escalating the confrontational situation that would cause them to use this weapon technology," end quote. Spagnuolo thinks the city is looking at weapons like a stun gun, which fires 20 seconds of pain from a shotgun. He also pointed to the LRAD, a long-range acoustic device that emits a tone to disable people. Blah, 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 blah. Operation Chaos. Hey, big man. Hey, pig man. Back to your phone calls. Edie is calling from Montgomery, Alabama, listening on the internet. Hey, Edie.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
How you doing?
I'm all right.
Okay. Something you touched on earlier reminded me about something McCain said. I think it was today. You said we know that people in other countries know how lame we are and that we torture and that we're a bunch of too many of us are just bloodthirsty monsters that don't do right from wrong, please. And he was talking about, get this, that Barack Obama wanted to meet with the leaders of Iran, and that meeting on with the President of the United States would give them an aura of respectability. Huh?
Yeah, I know. I know.
You know, I mean, that's just ridiculous. And he was saying this to a Jewish group, American Jews.
AIPAC, yeah.
I don't remember what if it was AIPAC or some other group. Mm-hmm. Oh, they applauded. Yeah. Anything you said against Obama or Iran, of course. And I just feel more and more like I'm like Alice in Wonderland, only worse, because it is no honor for anybody to meet with the President of the United States. It hasn't been for years.
Mm-hmm.
And I know most people don't know it. I'm afraid that most of us are still just droning through our existences and are just pissed off about the high price of gas. So that's all I got.
I hear you. All right, thanks, Edie.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for checking in. I still don't quite understand, and I'm not trying to be coy with you. I still don't understand why anyone who aspires to national political office in this case has, or in this country, has to make a required trip to AIPAC and state or declare without qualification that candidate will do everything in his or her power to ensure the integrity of the state of Israel. To the extent that other countries in the Middle East can burn or shut up or disappear or whatever. I don't get that. I can understand loyalties that are developed through alliances and through treaties. Really, I can. I really, really, really can. But this unquestioning, unqualified support for the state of Israel, I just can't understand why that has become a litmus test for any candidate who aspires to national office, and a hell of a lot of them who just want to be a state representative or a senator. What is that? What is that? I'm not looking to pick a fight with anybody here. It's an honest, genuine question. It comes from the heart because I can't figure it out in my head. So to any of my listeners who are of the Jewish persuasion, if you would like to provide for me an answer, I can't. I've thought about this for the better part of two decades. Why is it that a declaration of fealty, of unswerving dedication to the existence of the state of Israel, is absolutely necessary to American for American politicians if they want to succeed, or the illusion that that's necessary? Why is that? The Jewish population of the United States is what? 2 or 3 million? 4 million? What? Why that requirement? Why not make the same requirement to Catholics or leaving the religious arena to, I don't know, Irish people or Spaniards or what is that? Anyone want to take a shot at enlightening your apparently ignorant, humble, and obedient servant here? I would appreciate it.
People running around in circles. what they're headed for. Everybody's crying peace on earth just as soon as we win.
The Mike Malloy Show on Nova M Radio. Talk radio matters here.
Twenty-one past the hour. Back to your phone calls on the Malloy program. Evan is calling from Durham, North Carolina, listening on the internet. Evan, welcome to the program.
Yes, yes. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot.
Uh huh.
Well, I was calling because I was I'm looking at the video of Dick Cheney on at the National Press Club. I just stumbled on it, but I think Ian was telling me that Cheney made something similar to some sort of joke-like comment about West Virginia and. And let's see, his this thing that he has people named Cheney on both sides of his family, and even though they're not from West Virginia, an incest sort of a joke.
I hadn't
heard about that. It's on Huffington Post. But
okay, now what's the relevance of this, Evan?
Well, I was looking at that video. And the thing that came across my mind was just the gigantic shamelessness of Cheney to stand there and be so cordial and statesmanlike and even-tempered, and after all of this havoc and catastrophe that still goes on, and he's proud of it. You know, he's just very, very proud of
it. Well, I think one thing that we have to keep in mind, Evan, about Cheney is he's nuts, okay? He's out of his mind. And anything that he says is the result of oxygen deprivation to his brain because his heart runs on ball bearings or little microchips or whatever the hell it is. So I don't know what you're referring to with Cheney addressing the National Press Club or when that occurred, but he's nuts. All right. Thanks, Evan. I appreciate your call. Billy is calling from Georgia, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Billy.
Hello. How you doing, Mike?
I'm all right.
Yeah, the thing that gets me, I am so sick of this here as far as Israel. I mean, what interest do we have in Israel? You don't have any there and stuff.
Well,
and the people here, such as the lobbyists and the population as far as the Hebrews and stuff, if your loyalty lies with Israel, then go with Israel. The Palestinian issue is the main thing there that's causing all this turmoil. I mean, they're talking about Iran wants to destroy them. You go back in history, you show me where Iran has ever went to war against the Jews. They never have.
Okay. And so your question is, what do we owe the Israelis?
Yes, that's my question. Exactly.
All right. Well, it's a complicated. A complicated answer, Billy. Let me just try to give you a quick synopsis here. You know, we've had agreements, some of them known and some of them unknown, with Israel since the establishment of that state back in 1948. And in my opinion, they were based on two profound bases. One is the guilt felt by most of the world's leaders who were coherent about what had been perpetrated against the Jews, not the Israelis, but the Jews, for, 2,000 years? And the most recent example back then was the Holocaust. Secondly, was the absolute necessity for the United States to establish a strategic partner in a very critical area of the globe. And that was in the Middle East. So as a result of, I think, of those two circumstances, the United States formed an unbreakable alliance with Israel, which is fine. We have unbreakable alliances with the UK. Who else do we have unbreakable alliances with? Not too many other nations, right? But certainly with the UK and certainly with the State of Israel. So are those agreements still valid? As far as a mutual defense pact between the United States and Israel, that's kind of laughable. Israel no more needs our assistance in defending itself than we need theirs. We are both fully developed nuclear nations who can and just might launch those weapons, us for a second time, Israel for the first time, if provoked, or if even the thought of a provocation should come up. So the alliance has been there, the understanding, the agreement has been there for half a century. I just don't understand. Maybe we can, when we come back after the break, maybe Jeremy will have an answer. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Your Day Screaming with Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio.
It's about 26 before the hour. Excuse me. Jeremy is calling from Miami, listening on WINZ. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been a listener of you for years now, and you're actually a hero of mine. So I don't want you to take me as actually thinking that. I don't want to argue with you. I just, at all. So, I called and I just thought I could answer. I'm a Jewish progressive and a Democrat, and I do support Israel. And I think that, you know, AIPAC, I think it has influence for some reasons. I think Jewish people are very active. That's why I'm calling you and listening to you. I think that we get out there. I think that out of the left, the Jewish people, unfortunately, as a minority, are the most financially secure, so we can help out political causes in a different way sometimes than, you know, some guy who has a middle-class job who can't afford to fill up his gas tank. I can't really either, but, you know, I can beg my parents and maybe they'll help me out, you know? And I think that... that's a little off subject, but you know.
Well, let me pull it back on subject. I think
sure.
the question that I asked, mostly rhetorically, but certainly it deserves an answer if you've got one. Why is it that every politician who
runs for office has to, like you
well,
said,
who
pass like a litmus test with
who seeks national office? Has to make this pilgrimage almost. It's almost like going to Mecca or Rome to go before AIPAC and make an unequivocal declaration of utter absolute support, no matter what it does for the state of Israel. That's crazy.
And my answer would be that I think that it's presented that way a lot, but I think it's true. I think that They think they have to. I don't think anybody puts a gun to their head and says, like, you have to go. I think they go because they know they get a lot of support from people who pay a lot of attention. And that if they don't, then, you know, people like me will try and bust their balls about it. And
why? Why?
Well, because that's my interest. And I think because I support Israel. And if I won't bust their balls if they don't go to AIPAC.
Do you support Israel under any circumstances?
No, certainly not. I support it like I support America. Right, I support our troops.
No, wait. You understand, though, don't you, that AIPAC has a specific point of view that allows for no wiggle room at all where it concerns. Where it concerns those countries that Israel sees as a potential or a real enemy. There is no wiggle room. How many UN resolutions, for example, is Israel in violation of? 20? 100? 200?
I know, but I bet that America, the country where I live in, ranks higher.
What? I didn't hear that. What?
I think we're, America, where I live, we're just as high, if not higher. And I just think that a lot of countries violate a lot of rights, and that's not my litmus for who I support.
Okay, you're talking over me, which is kind of irritating. If you can't hear me, let's try a different connection. My question was, how many UN resolutions?
Let me
expand it. Do you have any idea how many UN resolutions regarding Israel's actions with the Palestinians have come down against Israel's actions and have demanded certain actions to remedy those actions, and Israel has ignored them? I realize that's a jerky question.
It's
all over the place. But there have been scores of resolutions. Now, my question to you, as a self-identified American Jew who supports AIPAC, I think you said you support AIPAC.
No, you don't support AIPAC.
Why do American politicians have to make this almost symbolic journey to AIPAC to address their conventions and say, no matter what you do, in essence what they're saying, no matter what the state of Israel does, I'll support it? Why is that?
I think they have the connotation that that's the way to win over my support. And I think that they get it wrong, just like the politicians get it wrong with pretty much everything.
Why do they need your support?
Because I'm going to show up to vote. I'm a very active progressive.
Why not declare unequivocal support to the policies of the African nation of Ghana?
I think we should. No,
smart-ass answers here.
I'm serious.
Since so many Americans of African descent have their heritage in Ghana, why not make a declaration of unequivocal support? No matter what the state of Ghana does, the U.S. will support it. That's crazy.
Yeah, you're right, but I have a question for you. That's a legitimate one. Is there even a lobby for Ghana? And is there an organized effort in the United States to support it?
I was giving you kind of a goofy example.
I'm giving you my realistic question. I'm young, and I don't really know everything.
Nice try, but you didn't answer my question. But I appreciate what you had to say. Maybe you almost answered it. Let me share with you something that that Bill sent me here regarding Eisenhower and the State of Israel when he was running for re-election in 1956, and at the same time trying to contain what at the time was growing instability in the Middle East as a result of tensions that were developing between Israel and its neighbors. And I think this was right around the time of the British-French-Israel mutual attack on Egypt, because Egypt had seized the Suez Canal and was in the process of nationalizing it. This is what Dwight Eisenhower wrote to a friend and an advisor. Quote, "Of course, nothing in that region would be so difficult to solve except for the underlying cause of the unrest and dissension that exists there, that is the Arab-Israel quarrel. This quarrel seems to have no limit in either intensity or in scope. Everybody in the Muslim and Jewish worlds is affected by it. It is so intense that the second any action is taken against one Arab state by an outsider, All the other Arab and Muslim states seem to regard it as a Jewish plot and react violently. All this complicates the situation enormously. As we began to uncover evidence that something was building up in Israel, we demanded pledges from Ben-Gurion that he would keep the peace. We realized that he might think he could take advantage of this country because of the approaching election and because of the importance that so many politicians in the past have attached to our Jewish vote. I gave strict orders to the State Department that they should inform Israel that we would handle our affairs exactly as though we didn't have a Jew in America. The welfare and best interests of our own country were to be the sole criterion on which we operated. Now, that's from a much lengthier letter, but as Bill writes, my, how times have changed. And Eisenhower, I don't think Eisenhower had a problem whatsoever with alliances and agreements, mutual pacts with Israel. But I think what Eisenhower, and it's turning out that this Republican president was almost prescient in so many of the things he talked about. Military-industrial complex, the taking of food out of the mouths of children in order to buy weapons and armaments, the entanglements that he tried to avoid where it concerned the Middle East. It seems like Eisenhower's point of view, though, was proper, wasn't it? That the interests of the United States, as long as we're going to have separate nation states, that the interests of the United States, the self-interest of the United States, should be the most critical insofar as making decisions is concerned, doesn't it? I mean, not that we would abandon an ally, whether that ally was the UK or how many allies do we have left? Or Turkey or Israel? Not that we would abandon an ally, certainly not. But again, my question, why it seems almost, I don't know, I don't know how to put it. An act of faith or an act of contrition or something. It almost is religious in its undertones that every politician aspiring to national office in this country has to get the approval of AIPAC. And that's what it is, the approval. Now, if you consider my question to be, he's anti-Semitic, well, turn off the radio. It's a fair question, and it's one that I approach out of a sense of ignorance. I understand the conflict. I understand the hatred in that sad part of the world. I understand the strategic value, the emotional value of the State of Israel. But what I don't understand is this absolute requirement of U.S. politicians to make that pilgrimage to AIPAC. I don't get it. Before the hour. All right, some quick emails here regarding AIPAC and U.S. politicians. Reg writes, this is not about supporting Israel. Oh, she's referring to the guy from Miami who was trying to answer me. Reg writes, this is not about supporting Israel. The unanswerable question is, why is it forbidden for anyone to publicly criticize anything Israel does? And any politician who dares to suggest that the Palestinian question should be addressed with any honesty is doomed. P.S. Israel is in violation of 68 U.N. resolutions. Well, I know it was a bunch. Yeah, that's the part that bothers me. Any politician who dares to suggest that the Palestinian question should be addressed with any honesty is doomed. How can they be doomed by such a minority population that makes up the American electorate? I don't get that. Dino writes, Mike, before I put in my two cents regarding Israel, I should point out that besides the strong ties with the UK, the United States has very strong ties with Canada. As you pointed out in recent broadcasts, Canada is America's number one supplier of fossil fuels. Our two countries carry on trade in billions of dollars every year. As well as the trade treaties, we are partners in NORAD with the second in command in Colorado, and the second in command in Colorado is a Canadian. As for Israel, the West's support for that country was explained to me by a conservative friend. Essentially, Israel is a democracy in a sea of religious zealots and dictatorships, which the West has supported. But the fact that my friend glosses over very quickly, the democratic West needs to protect this democracy, which is surrounded by countries who want to destroy it. Dino, North Toronto. Well, in the first place, I disagree with you that Israel is a democracy in the sense that I think you mean it. If it is a democracy with majority rule and the protection of a democratic republic, I should say. Well, you may be right. It may be a pure democracy, majority rules. But the majority in what constitutes greater Israel, as laid out by people like Ariel Sharon, is not Jewish. The majority of people, I think, in that sad part of the world is Arab. That's why so many of the Palestinians are not allowed the same civil and human rights as the Israeli citizens, right? Oh, God, it's turning into one of those discussions, isn't it? And Shelley writes, American Jews' support of Israel has been consistent since 1948. Eisenhower and Kennedy did not have that view. The Yom Kippur War of 1973 changed the U.S. view of its oil interests after that war. You may remember the first oil shortage of 1973 when Nixon started price controls. U.S. policy then shifted to support our oil interests in the region, as well as the Cold War fight with the USSR. Israel is a surrogate force in the region and advances U.S. policy. Furthermore, the right wing has also supported Israel in a biblical sense. Israel is supported by both political parties. American Jews have less influence than you think. It is all about oil. Okay, but none of these emails answers my question. Not one. As a matter of fact, Reg restated the question. The question is, you know, I'm not looking for necessarily for the validity or invalidity of that support, but why every American politician has to bow down, metaphorically speaking, to AIPAC. Thanks to the crew for tonight's program. Ian Huff, who engineered and answered your calls. Billy Foster, our technical director, Ben Birch, the podcast manager, Bob Alexander, our resident philosopher, Bridget Wolf, our writer in residence, Sharon Gordy, our military affairs correspondent, and the executive producer of this program, Catherine Bay. Robert is calling from Miami, also listening on WINZ tonight. Robert, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello, Mike.
Hey.
Yeah, I tried to get some of this in, but I have. I worried about Barack Obama in the sense of last year, about 9 months ago when this thing was starting, I assumed Gore, you probably did too, we assumed Gore was going to get into it, we were going to wipe out the Republicans, steamroller them and win 56% of the vote, etc. He doesn't get in, then Edwards, the same thing, I'm for Edwards, I voted for Edwards here. And then that fizzles, and so it's down to Hillary, and then Hillary becomes better and better as a campaigner as the primaries continue, and then she ends up losing it by a narrow, and the delegates narrowly, I guess, today. And, but, you know, it's disturbing to me because she wins 36%, by 36% margin in Puerto Rico, where the white and the black Americans together are less than 1% of the people there, so you can't say it's just white people in West Virginia voting for her. And I feel that Barack is not yet, maybe he will, but so far he's not really paying attention that he needs to reach out more rather than just talk about reaching out more. And I'll give you an example. I'm at this rally in Sunrise, Florida, which Barack called Sunshine because his Handler should have just told them, just say Fort Lauderdale. It's really Fort Lauderdale. Nobody really lives there. It's a stadium. It's a city where a stadium is. That's what it is.
All right.
But anyway, so I'm there, and everyone was super nice and everything there, but it's about 60% black, and 7,000 people turned out. So on the upside, you could say, well, we turned out 7,000 people. That's great. But only about 40% of them were white, and I think that it's true that if McCain had a rally there, a lot less people would show up, and they would almost all be white and Hispanic. But he plays this video beforehand, and it's Will.i.am, who's this black singer from Black Eyed Peas, and almost the majority of the people in the video he plays before he comes onto the stage and makes his, you know, his entrance, most of those people are black. I'm thinking, well, the blacks, 93% of them vote for the Democrats. That's great. But you've got to reach out to the people who aren't going to vote for the Democrats. That's what you have to be thinking about. If he's saying that we're in the general election now, which he's saying, he has to be thinking, this is not a caucus. This is not where you're
going to... Wait. Let me ask you something, because we're rapidly running out of time here.
I know.
You probably won't be able to answer it. As a matter of fact, we are absolutely running out of time.
Right.
Robert, we'll have to pick up the discussion some other time. But my point would have been, is how does Barack Obama reach out to white people? I mean, he's stating a message that, in my opinion, is kind of universal. It's not directed at blacks. I think one of the reasons maybe people feel he has to reach out to white people is because white people are so goddamn racist. You suppose? I'll see you tomorrow night. I'm Mike Malloy. Take care. Keep it lit. This is Nova M Radio.